Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello there, Buzzkillers. You may remember a few episodes ago, Professor Nash on one of our shows mentioned that there was a new video that had recently emerged about that had President Roosevelt, FDR, in his wheelchair. It's the first time anyone had seen a video of him in his wheelchair. Very, very short clip. And Buzzkill Institute researchers started digging more into the question of how FDR's disability was handled by the press. And I had always thought that the story about FDR's polio was relatively ignored by the public because it was a combination of the compliant press and also the public already knowing about the disability, but not considering it a handicap. Well, like most people, I was wrong on both counts. Here to set us straight is Professor Matthew Pressman of Seton Hall University, who's going to enlighten us on the myths and realities of the history of FDR, his polio, and the press. Hello there, Professor. How are you? It's great to have you over the interwebs.
Doing very well. Thanks for having me.
And how is the work? I know you're working on a new book now. How is that going?
It's going well. I'm leaving the period of the 1930s and 40s with FDR and moving closer to the present, the 1960s and 70s up to today. And I hope to have that book published next year. It's under contract with Harvard University Press.
That's fantastic. And we have an announcement at the end of the show about an award you've recently received, but we want to keep that in suspense. And we're going to keep the Buzzkillers in suspense. The Buzzkill Institute researchers told me about your article, which has the fabulous title, Ambivalent Accomplices, How the Press Handled FDR's Disability and How FDR Handled the Press. That's what we're going to talk about today. And it's one of these articles that not only removes the scale drop from my eyes when I was able to go through the whole thing and read all the complications, but it's perfect for this show. Right. So can you give us some background on, I thought it was fascinating, it's the first time I'd ever read, for instance, how FDR contracted got polio and the early fears about what it would mean. What happened?
Sure, yeah. So FDR had a long political career before contracting polio. He was an able-bodied person. He set out to be president. He was extremely ambitious and set out to be president from a young age and wanted to sort of follow the path of his distant cousin, Theodore Roosevelt, served in the same position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy after having been a congressional representative from New York State. And FDR was the vice presidential candidate of the Democratic Party in 1920. The following year that he went down to a crushing defeat, I should add, he and running mate James Cox to Warren G. Harding. And the following year, while on vacation in Maine, in Campobello Island, FDR, at age 39, contracted polio. And he contracted a very severe case. He was unable to move his entire body, you know, up to the neck. And for a time, it looked as if his life might actually be in danger.
And they also called it something different back then. They often referred to it as infantile paralysis. Is that right?
Right. I think that term is still sometimes used. But yes, more generally, polio or poliomyelitis was called infantile paralysis, because it struck children more frequently than adults, although adults, as FDR showed, could certainly contract it as well. But yes, infantile because it struck children, and paralysis because it tended to paralyze the muscles, especially of the lower body. And that's what it did to Franklin Roosevelt.
So what were the sort of immediate reactions of either the press or more importantly, I guess his staff and his political circle? What did they think? Because in your article, you quite rightly point out that it creeps all the way up to his chest. It looks like he might die.
Right. Well. Of course, the primary concern is make sure he doesn't die.
Yeah.
But once the mortal danger has passed, he and his team, including his wife Eleanor and his longtime close aide Lewis Howe, they start thinking almost immediately about his political future. And Roosevelt was very determined that this wasn't going to end his political career. So they started to plot the comeback pretty quickly.
Okay.
And it certainly took a few years. He was focused on his recovery, but at every step he and his advisors were trying to frame this for the press to kind of minimize just how bad it was.
Now, this is before he'd been elected governor, right?
Oh yeah, no. So this time he was out of public. He had lost the vice presidential election in 1920, and so he didn't have an active role in public life. He had a private law practice that was kind of a fallback, a private law practice in New York City, and so he doesn't really re-enter the public scene for 3 years after contracting polio. His first attempt to start his comeback comes at the Democratic National Convention in 1924, where he gives this famous speech on behalf of the governor of New York, nominating him for the nomination, Al Smith, the so-called Happy Warrior speech, where he describes Smith as a happy warrior on the field, the battlefield of politics. But when he gave this speech, he had to approach the podium on crutches. And although, of course, it wasn't televised and probably very few people even saw it on newsreels, the newspapers at the time were very vivid in their description of his disability, because, you know, this was the thing that most people associated with FDR. Yes, they knew he'd been vice president. They knew about the famous Roosevelt name. I'm sorry, vice presidential candidate. Not president. They knew about the Roosevelt name. And if they knew anything else, it was that he'd gotten polio and been nearly paralyzed. So there was a great deal of public curiosity, and the newspapers had very vivid descriptions, especially the Republican newspapers. Most newspapers were quite partisan in those days. The Republican newspapers were really a little bit nasty about the creeping inroads of infantile paralysis, one said, and talked about how he had to be virtually carried up the stairs. So so vivid descriptions that clearly they weren't exactly what FDR and his team wanted. They didn't really want to have him be presented as someone sort of pitiful and helpless. They felt that would spell political doom for him.
So it's not true there then that people didn't know. Lots of people knew. If it's in the press, or at least in half of the press, so to speak, then a lot of people are going to already know about it, at least in New York.
Right, certainly. And I think even nationwide, you know, it was this nomination speech was reported across the country in papers from Los Angeles to Chicago to the East Coast and the South. And certainly it was so widely known that FDR and his advisors, they couldn't try to avoid it. There would be no thought of that. So instead of trying to avoid it or hide it, they essentially just tried to spin it, you know, and to always minimize the lingering effects, and to talk about how he was on the road to recovery, and that, you know, yes, of course he'd had polio, but he was now mostly better. That was the kind of line that it was a story of overcoming adversity, which of course is a very inspirational story that voters will identify with and admire. He and his advisors wanted him to be, of course, admired rather than pitied or something like that.
So this is all happening during the race for governor, the first race for governor, that the advisors are coming up with this strategy of saying, well, let's use it, at least in a minimal way, as a way to say this is a man of great strength who's overcome this terrible thing that kills most people, or maybe doesn't kill most people, but certainly cripples most people.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And when he decides to make his run for governor is in 1928, he runs for governor of New York. And again, you can't avoid the issue. It's probably the biggest issue on the campaign trail was, is he physically fit to be governor of the state of New York?
Right. Well, so at that time, the biggest state in the union. Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Population wise anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how does it sort of affect him during the time as governor? At least how is he portrayed by the press during his time as governor? He and the disability.
Right. The moment where it's most important is during the campaign, because really this is the big stumbling block to him getting elected is, are people going to think he's not fit for the office? Mm-hmm. And so he really tackles the issue head on, and he feels like the best way to address it is to show that he's really vigorous and active, which of course he was.
Uh-huh.
So in many of his, and he mounted this campaign where he traveled all across New York State. He would talk about how active a schedule he had. He would give 7 speeches in 7 different cities on the same day. And he would sort of joke about, oh, my opponents say I'm this poor, sick man, but look at this. I've already been to 5 other cities today, and here I am speaking to you, and I don't look too sick, do I? And of course, he did, because he managed to present this appearance that he could stand up because he used leg braces, and he would hold on to the bar of a podium or a companion, often his son. And so he would, of course, deliver his speeches from a standing position, even though he couldn't really walk.
You may not know this, but were the leg braces under his pants, under his trousers, so they weren't visible to photographers? Okay.
Right. They were under his trousers. But they do show up in news photographs. Certainly you can see, they would come out when he's sitting down, you see part of his sock and you can see the leg braces.
Oh, right.
In several photographs.
Now, while he's governor, presumably some things must have gone wrong politics-wise and policy-wise and implementing policy-wise. Are there times when the opposition newspaper said, well, you see, this is what happens when you elect someone who's disabled to a high office? They can't pull it off. They can't do the job.
I didn't really come across that, actually. It was much more of an issue during the campaign, and I didn't find a lot of examples of that once he was in office, to be honest.
Okay, well then, the next big campaign that he's in is, of course, the 1932 run for the presidency. Did they adopt the same sort of strategy?
Yes, in many ways, it was kind of like a replay of the 1928 gubernatorial campaign, because he had to convince the country now, not just the voters of New York, that he was physically fit. And as I said, the country, if there's a couple things they know about Franklin Roosevelt, one of them is that he was paralyzed and he had polio.
So people knew. This is the big thing that I think most buzzkillers don't get, and this is the pervasive myth. People did know. Most people did
know.
Yes,
absolutely. Absolutely, I think so.
Okay.
So it's hard to know the extent of, right, you know, did everyone know how severe the paralysis was? But certainly people knew that he had been paralyzed and that he'd had polio.
Okay, so what other things did the campaign do in particular to, I don't know, soften the image or boost up this image of he overcame this terrible thing? It must have been a massive PR campaign.
It was, yes, it really was. And it started early. You know, he didn't announce his candidacy until 1932, but he had been laying the groundwork earlier. And one of my favorite examples is in 1931, there was an article in one of the highest circulation magazines in the country called Liberty Magazine, which had a circulation of several million.
Wow.
And the title was, "Is Franklin D. Roosevelt Physically Fit to Be President?" And the way it was framed, the author was a journalist who said, you know, "I'm a Republican and I was just curious just whether Roosevelt is really up to the job of leading the country. So I sent him a letter and I challenged him to show me, to demonstrate that he's physically fit to be president." And the governor, you know, he gamely accepted my challenge. I'm paraphrasing the article here.
Yeah.
But the conclusion of the article was, to this author's, you know, professed surprise, it turns out that Roosevelt is tremendously fit and there's no real doubt about his physical ability to do the job. Mm-hmm. Now, the backstory is that this this writer was not just a random Republican journalist. He happened to be a close friend of the Roosevelt family.
Ah.
Yes. So, in fact, when I was looking through the Franklin D. Roosevelt papers at the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, New York, I came across some really fascinating correspondence between Roosevelt and this author, a guy named Earl Looker. And, I was not sure. Well, did they sort of concoct this together, or was it an honest organic thing? And sometimes you just find that document that says exactly what you're looking for and removes all doubt. And I did find that in this case. Just after the article went to press, there was a letter from the author Earl Looker to Franklin Roosevelt, and Looker wrote, "Well, sir, we got away with the Liberty article despite all the obstacles."
That's pretty obvious.
Yes, that pretty much settled the question, I think, for me of whether this was, you know, a legitimate piece of journalism or more of a PR stunt.
How else did the campaign and did Roosevelt or did the media handle this in 32? I mean, there must have been backroom meetings of Republicans saying, we've got to exploit this. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way. I'm just saying that this is a political reality. We've got to make use of it. Is there any evidence of that?
I think there was some hesitation on the part of the Republicans, because they thought it could kind of backfire, you know, that it might be seen as kind of a cheap shot. Certainly it didn't work at all when the New York State Republicans tried to use that as a weapon against Roosevelt in 1928. And so I think there was a little bit of hesitation in 1932 to employ those kind of techniques. You know, one sort of history myth, since we are on Professor Buzzkill, you know, one thing that people often think about the past is that, oh, you know, it was sort of a more civil era in terms of politics. And that's not all. That is a myth, I think, for the most part. But there's some truth to it. And I think in this instance, there was a little bit of a hesitation to try to exploit Roosevelt's disability this way. You see, once he became president, I came across a couple of examples of Republican politicians who gave speeches or made public remarks in which they kind of took shots at Roosevelt. In one instance, the governor of Georgia was talking about how he thought the next president should be a man who can walk a 2x4 plank, is what he said.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, the problem with Roosevelt is he can't go walk around and talk to people.
Yeah.
Because of course he's wheelchair bound.
But
and these comments got a lot of blowback, actually, and caused that governor of Georgia to lose a lot of his editorial support from Democratic newspapers.
I'm interested because I sometimes wonder whether, you know, things were so bad in 33 when FDR becomes president, inaugurated in 33, and the Depression is really starting to be in full swing, and he has to deal with the bank crisis and all that sort of stuff, whether the public would have reacted if Republicans or other FDR opponents had gone on a big campaign of his disability. The public might have reacted saying, look, we have much more serious problems to deal with here. We lay off. I mean, we don't like to speculate on the show, because speculation is one of the things that leads to the urban legends that become myths. But I often feel that that might have been the case.
Yes, I think you're right. I think there's a lot to that.
Okay, so what else happens in his early years as president? Do they continue this basic strategy of trying to, you know, reduce the amount of talk or imagery about the disability and concentrate on the issues, or do they all still talk about this overcoming this great problem?
Yes, they did talk about overcoming the adversity that FDR had faced, and it was actually rather fitting, because, you know, the president in a way is the emblem of the nation, right? And he tends to personify the nation. And so FDR could really turn this to his advantage and make this compelling point, an analogy between his personal story and the story of what the nation was going through. So, you know, of course, the Great Depression had struck a few years ago. They're in the depths of it in the early years of his first term. And so he often made this analogy, and his supporters did, that, you know, the country was paralyzed by depression, but now it was on the road to recovery. And, you know, of course, there were still some lingering effects of the illness, but for the most part, things were getting better. And, you know, it wasn't going to go back to the horrible way things were before. And this was very similar to the narrative that FDR and his advisors constructed about his own physical condition. That, of course, yes, there was this terrible calamity that befell him, but through hard work and perseverance, he had managed to get back on his feet. He often would use terms like that, mm-hmm. and sort of be returned to health and vigor the same way that the national economy would be under his stewardship, he hoped.
Perhaps the most fascinating thing to me about how all this happened in the 30s and 40s, as you described so wonderfully in your article about this, is that it was a completely different way it was treated. The images that would come out in media, photographs, cartoons, or whatever, versus the text, the printed written stories. Can you tell us a little bit about, first, let's tackle images first. You know, what did the photographers do? How did the president react to photographers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so we think of the sort of media presidency as really starting in the 1960s with JFK and the importance of image. But it was important in the 1930s as well with FDR, even though there were far fewer moving images. Mm-hmm. And the big priority in terms of how his disability was depicted, the big priority for FDR and his team was they didn't want images that showed him as really kind of helpless or wheelchair bound. So once he was in office, once he was in the White House, he and his team had no hesitation about really using all the tools and the power of the office to prevent any kinds of negative images from being published. So if the Secret Service saw a photographer or a newsreel cameraman trying to take a picture, for instance, of FDR being pushed in his wheelchair or him getting into or out of his car, which he had to be physically lifted by someone or by two people to get in and out of his car, they would actually physically take the camera, snatch it from the photographer. They would expose the film to sunlight, or they would smash the photographic plates. And this was something that a lot of journalists found a little bit shocking to have the images subject to this kind of censorship.
So there's a very direct and there's a very physical grabbing of the material and destroying it. So the Secret Service should be, well, in theory, the Secret Service is supposed to be protecting the president. And I guess that they are protecting his image as well. But that seems to destroy completely the gentleman's agreement that we'll put our cameras down whenever he's in one of these, if you will, compromising situations.
Right. I think that's one of the big myths about FDR's disability and how it was depicted, was that it was this gentleman's agreement. And in my view, the fact that the Secret Service enforced the ban on unflattering images of him in this way, that kind of puts the lie to the gentleman's agreement notion. I mean, certainly Roosevelt would have preferred if he could have gotten all the photographers to voluntarily go along with this, but but he wasn't willing to just rely on their goodwill alone. He also had the Secret Service really take these pretty extreme measures to try to prevent any unflattering images from being presented to the public.
So were there any photographers that we know of anyway who said, "Well, wait a minute, no," and then backed off and refused to hand their cameras over and that sort of thing?
Well, I did as much as I could to sort of scour the archives and publish material for images. I believe at the FDR Library, there's only a couple pictures of him in a wheelchair at all, which were not published during his lifetime. I found one image of the president in a wheelchair that was published. So in 1937, Life magazine, which is the highest circulation magazine in the country, published the only photograph that I could find of Roosevelt in a wheelchair. But if it weren't for the caption, you wouldn't even know it was Roosevelt. The shot is from maybe 100 feet away. The main thing you see is the backs of two security guards at a hospital where Roosevelt was going to visit a sick member of his cabinet. And the caption identifies him as the president. And you see that there's a figure being pushed in a wheelchair. But that was really the closest that any photographer apparently was able to get. And incidentally, when this image came out, Roosevelt's press secretary was furious and talking about what kind of steps they could take to sort of punish Life magazine and its publisher, Henry Luce, who was a political opponent of the president's, and how they could prevent this kind of image from being published again.
Yeah, how did they handle things like editorial cartoons and things like that, which would seem to be much more difficult to do because you can't get in the way, in theory, of the cartoon's drawing board and the cartoonist's drawing board and the newspaper editor he turns it into. I can understand smashing the cameras or taking the film. That sort of is obvious mm-hmm. right at the moment. But were there editorial cartoons or you know, satirical cartoons making fun of him?
You're right that that's something that they would not really have been able to control very easily. And no, I did not actually come across. And other scholars, a scholar from the 1940s actually did a very detailed analysis of editorial cartoons of Roosevelt and didn't find anything depicting his disability in an unflattering way or even in any way. In fact, it was usually the opposite. you know, it kind of makes sense because he revolutionized the office of the president so much, and he was so much more of an activist president than most of his predecessors, that the editorial cartoonists depicted him in these very active ways, you know, always running or as a quarterback or a boxer. Wow. So really the polar opposite of his actual physical condition, but maybe a fair representation of the level of activity he brought to the job of president.
Oh, speaking of, you know, polar opposites, what I found so fascinating about this new research is that you show very clearly that FDR's disability as presented in print journalism is very different. It was very different in the 30s and 40s. Again, knocking down the idea that nobody knew or people generally didn't know.
Right. Yeah. So it's not as if every article that was published about the president got in some mention of his disability. Most of the routine articles about the day-to-day activities of government, you know, it wasn't relevant. And the assumption was that people already understood that he had some lingering effects of his disability. But when there were more in-depth profiles that aimed to sort of show Roosevelt's daily life, they didn't shy away at all from depicting the realities of how he got around. So in major magazines like Time Magazine, The New Yorker, Life Magazine, there were multiple references that I found published during his presidency talking about how he used a wheelchair to get around, sometimes talking about how he would be lifted in and out of his car, talking about how he had ramps installed at the White House instead of stairs. So it wasn't as if it was a constant topic of conversation in the press, but when there were these profiles that showed his day-to-day life, they were pretty honest and open in their handling of his disability.
That's amazing. You know, they keep talking about, you know, he's overcome his disability, but this is sort of 20 years after he's been afflicted by polio. Or, you know, is there anybody who's saying, oh, look, this is continuing. He's not as if he can, when he's 50 or 60, he can get rid of the leg braces. Why, you know, in other words, people are saying he's a great president from the chest up.
Yeah, I suppose so. Essentially, right. Yeah, this doesn't really impact his ability to do the job. And of course, in fairness, it didn't impact his ability to do the job. Although, I don't know if we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but one thing I find fascinating is the way that once he actually did have some serious health problems, the press didn't really report on those in as open or honest a way as they might have.
Oh, are you talking about later on in the 40s when he's, especially 44, 45, when he's dying more or less?
Exactly, right.
In this context, we should go on to talk about how his presidency ends and how it all sort of fades out health-wise and how the press reacts to it.
Right, so by the election of 1944, he's running for his fourth term as president. It's, of course, the middle of World War II. And it's pretty clear to most observers that he's having some serious health problems. You know, he had serious heart problems. He winds up dying in office of congestive heart failure in April of 1945. But the health problems were apparent much earlier when he made his announcement in a press conference in 1944 that he was planning to run for re-election yet again. One reporter in a later memoir that he wrote described how FDR, who was an inveterate smoker, he was holding his cigarette as he always did, but his hand was shaking so much that he was getting cigarette ash all over himself as he was making this announcement. He couldn't even keep his hand steady. But no mention of that appeared certainly in the press accounts of his announcement of his reelection. But it was really hard to avoid. Because he also lost a tremendous amount of weight. The photographs alone, just of his face, showed how he looked like a much sicker person in 1944 than he had been a few years earlier. And so he was asked about this naturally, and his doctors were asked about it. But he played it off. His doctors said he was just fine. You know, there were no serious health problems. And they actually kind of tied it back to the norms that had been set earlier, saying that, you know, it's unfair, it's a cheap shot to criticize the president's health. You know, this is what his opponents have always tried to do. They've tried to criticize his health because of his polio, but, you know, that's totally baseless and it doesn't affect his ability. But of course, this wasn't polio. These were separate health issues, and they were really arguably affecting his ability to do the job. Certainly would affect his ability to serve out his term.
Yeah, and they end up killing him in 40-45.
Yes, right.
Right. One of the things that's so fascinating about learning more about this whole event, this whole sort of episode in American history, is that FDR sort of took a personal management, a personal role in how his disability was presented, and he also kind of took a personal role in critiquing the press and opponents about his disability. What was the kind of range of his own reaction to these written reports about polio?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the most active role he took was at the early stage of his career. For instance, in 1928, when he was running for governor of New York, if there was a newspaper editorial that questioned his physical fitness, he would personally reach out and write a letter to the publisher, the editor of that newspaper. You know, these very polite letters, but making an argument for why it was unfair to criticize him mm-hmm. in this way. So, as I said, FDR managed to craft this narrative that he had overcome this illness, which for the most part, of course, he had. But he didn't at all shy away from metaphors related to it. And he often used health-related metaphors. A lot of students of history might be familiar with his famous declaration when the U.S. entered World War II that Dr. New Deal was leaving the room and the patient, the country, was now going to be attended to by Dr. Win the War. But he often spoke in these similar terms, and there's a terrific audio clip that we have courtesy of the Franklin Roosevelt Presidential Library, where in the 1936 election campaign, he kind of turns the situation around and his political opponents, the big business forces that were opposed to his reelection, saying how they had been so sick and paralyzed in the early years of the Depression, and he had cured them. And now, you know, now that they were back on their feet, they didn't want any government meddling with their affairs. And the phrase that he uses is that they're like the patient who throws his crutches at the doctor.
Right. The idea is that, you know, we got you out of, we revived you, we saved you from death. And now you're complaining that you don't want to take your medicine that in fact saved you. And we have that clip here. So let's have a listen.
Today, for the first time in 7 years, the banker, the storekeeper, the small factory owner, the industrialist can all sit back and enjoy the company of their own ledgers. They're in the black, and that's where we want them to be. That is where our policies aim that they shall be. That is where we intend them to be in the days to come. Some of these people really forget how sick they were. But I know how sick they were. I have their fever charts. I know how all the knees of all our rugged individualists were trembling 4 years ago and how their hearts fluttered. They came to Washington in great numbers. Washington didn't look like a dangerous bureaucracy to them then. No, it looked like an emergency hospital. And all of these distinguished patients wanted two things and wanted it in a hurry. They wanted a quick hypodermic to end the pain. And they wanted a course of treatment to cure the disease. And we gave them both. And now, my friends, most of the patients seem to be doing very nicely. And some of them are even well enough to throw their crutches at the doctor.
Okay, well, that's a pretty strong sort of use of medical terms and medical sort of allusions and medical parallels towards political opponents. Was there any sort of reaction against this? As people say, well, if you're gonna bring up, you know, being saved from death and medical conditions, then we're going to talk about polio.
I didn't really find too much of that. Really, I think he was very effective in casting himself in this role as the person who'd sort of been through the fire and made it out the other side. It was very much the same message that was conveyed by his decision to create this foundation for infantile paralysis, the March of Dimes, which of course continues to today and continues to do great work. And it was a foundation to raise money from the American people to find a cure for polio. But it was, his appeals were usually framed as, you know, look what medical treatment did for me. I had polio. Now I'm president and doing all these amazing things. So I want to help others achieve the same kind of turnaround, achieve the same kind of recovery that I've achieved. And so that was yet another way for him to cast himself in this heroic role rather than being in a role of being pitied in any way, which of course he and his advisors were determined to avoid.
Well, having said that about the March of Dimes, I'm going to now speculate, which again, buzzkillers, I hate to do, but as many of you may know, or any of you old recovered coin collectors like I am, know that the dime as the coin in Roosevelt's day was a mercury-headed dime, we call the mercury-headed dime or winged Liberty dime. But then later, who gets chosen as the new image for the dime but Franklin Roosevelt, after presumably he's already established the March of Dimes? We don't want to say that that's an absolute connection, but it sure sounds like one.
No, I'm pretty sure that it is a connection. Yes.
Okay. Well, we're gonna look into that. Maybe we'll have another episode with you soon. It seems to me so fascinating that if the press coverage of FDR's polio and disability was a general sort of general gentleman's agreement, if you will, it's one of the most complicated and misunderstood gentleman's agreement in modern history. It goes back and forth. It's managed on both sides. It seems to be extremely complicated.
Yes, most things are more complicated, right? We historians, we love those nuanced, complex explanations, and I think this is definitely a case where the nuanced, complex explanation is probably the closest to the truth as we can get.
And that's why we get the big money here at the Institute. Listen, I want to announce to the Buzzkillers that you've recently been awarded, in fact, just awarded from the American Journalism Historians Association, the 2017 Blanchard Dissertation Prize. When did you heard about this? Just the other day, yeah.
Yes, just last week they gave me the good news. I was very very honored and flattered that the panel chose my dissertation. Honors the best dissertation published each year about mass communication history. So that was really a nice thing to hear and gives me some inspiration to try to do my best to adapt this dissertation into the best possible book, which is my current preoccupation.
Well, we normally ask historians we interview what are you researching next? So why don't you tell the Buzzkillers about that book?
Sure. So my book's makes the argument that the characteristics, the values of the contemporary American media were really shaped in the period of the 1960s and 1970s. And that they've only begun to change more recently in the past few years with the rise of hyperpartisan media and the age of Donald Trump, but that really for the several decades from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, these values such as adversarialism a focus on soft news and reader service, an emphasis on interpretation. They really guide the mainstream media and kind of make the news media what most people think it is today.
Okay.
And that is most people think for good or ill. And I think it's also the era where the very familiar conservative critique of the media as having a liberal elitist bias arises. And also the sometimes overlooked critique from the left that the news media has a kind of establishment bias or conservative bias and simply upholds the status quo. But certainly the values that emerged from the 1960s and 70s, those values were not at all in place when Franklin Roosevelt was president. And it would have been certainly a different story for him and his disability had he been president in a later era.
Well, we look forward to the book coming out, and we'll certainly put it on the Buzzkill bookshelf. So thanks, Professor, and we'll talk to you, Buzzkillers, next week.
Thank you.